We have, as I mentioned, we're going to have two keynote presentations to Premier Institute researchers, giving presentations about their area of specialty and their focus. So we have the first one now. This is Jonathan Walgate, one of our postdoctoral students. And he's originally, as you'll be able to tell from his accent, from England. He did his PhD at Oxford University there. And there was quantum information. So this kind of ties in well with all of the things you saw at quantum computing when people were talking about entanglement. You met Alison Ball, quantum cryptography, quantum key distribution. So Jonathan, even though he's from England, actually has quite experience in Canada, and actually spent 2 years in Calgary, at the University of Calgary there, doing a postdoc. So his hobbies include rock climbing and hiking, and I understand that he has noticed a little bit of a difference in terms of the hiking and rock climbing between Calgary and apparently some subtle differences. So today, you can move John from Walgate.
Thank you. Okay, so I'm going to talk about, hopefully, quantum information, entanglement, and non-locality, which is a huge area, so all I'm going to be able to do is touch it. But if there's any point, you've doubtless been told it millions of times by Dan, and probably need no encouragement, but if there is any point you want me to expound upon or go off at a tangent or something, just interrupt me and away we'll go. Specifically, I want to introduce kind of the fundamental ideas behind approaching quantum mechanics and physics in general from an information theoretic perspective, which is perhaps not the most traditional way to start thinking about physics. So we'll explore the insights underpinning quantum information. And then building on that, I'll try and introduce entanglement such that in as clear a way as I can manage, which is pretty poor seeing as no one actually understands what it is. So I'll try and introduce entanglement, and in particular, I'll introduce and talk about non-locality, which is perhaps the strangest feature of quantum mechanics we know at the moment. And it's the feature of entanglement in particular that gets everyone completely confused, where apparently distant objects can somehow seem to be correlated with one another, or they have some kind of concerted behavior, despite the fact that we know for a fact they can't be talking to one another. What makes the universe seem like a giant conspiracy. So hopefully I'll get to that, and I'll talk about the state of the art in terms of proofs and tests for the fact that the world is actually non-local and quantum mechanics is true and our intuitions are completely misguided. But to get to that, we'll have to go through a bit of quantum information first. So there were loads of ways of introducing quantum theory, and you're doubtless going to be exposed to quite a few of them here. And with any luck, that the different people who'll talk to you about quantum theory will all have different and mutually contradictory ways of explaining it. So this is my way of looking at it to start with. First of all, I'd observe quantum theory by itself is not a complete theory of physics. I mean, quantum mechanics is obviously part of physics, but what quantum theory does simply by itself is not tell you which electron is going where the particle is going to be when, etc., etc., etc. What it does is it provides a mathematical structure, a framework, a kind of, some kind of scaffolding on which you can place whatever physical properties and physical objects you want. You just slot them into the appropriate holes in the theory. And all of a sudden, if you add these concepts like, well, let's say that this particular part of quantum mechanics is talking about position, and let's say that the objects we want to talk about are electrons, so I'll introduce some charge, notion of charge into quantum theory, and such like and so forth. You just introduce all these properties, mix it up, and the framework turns out to fit reality. And you get a full physical theory. But this is kind of remarkable, really, that one framework, one size fits all, really. So exactly the same mathematical formalism, mathematical structure, would explain what photons are doing, where they are, where they're going. It explains what electrons do when, it's clearly a good picture of an electron, but the best I can drag off Google Images. It explains what atoms are doing, the relative excitation levels inside atoms. It explains how molecules behave, the bonds between molecules vibrating and so on and so forth. And it explains where buckyballs go when you try to diffract them, which is not many people try to do, but it's worth trying to do. It explains how every fundamental system of the universe seems to work. And that's really kind of remarkable. There's no reason Newton should have suspected, for example, that apples falling from trees obey the same rules that planets do when they're orbiting the sun. The two things seem entirely disjoint. Should be entirely different rules governing those two things, and yet turns out one rule fits all for gravity. And the remarkable thing about quantum mechanics is that's taken to the extreme. One set of rules fits everything, period. And in particular, it's fun to look at because there's some damn crazy rules. You'd think as people living in our own universe and being relatively reproductively successful, we ought to have some intuitive ideas about how the universe works, which should work. But boy, do we not. Intuition is a real hindrance for a quantum physicist, really. It leads you astray more often than it leads you to the correct result. Quantum information theory, really, and study of quantum theory in particular, is the business of looking at these counterintuitive rules and trying to work out, trying to discard our intuitions to an extent, or only preserve those of them that are useful, and work out what the universe is up to. So there's really two motivations for looking at quantum theory in particular. For kind of putting to one side the fact that we're talking about electrons and this is the from quantum information theory perspective, you just put aside the fact that we're talking about specific objects, about electrons, about photons, about atoms and such like. That doesn't matter. They're all going to behave the same rule. They couldn't be the same rules in any case. Let's look at the rules and see what on earth they're up to. So there are two real motivations we use to explain why on earth we bother to do this. The first of these rules is the kind of one you put on your grant proposal when you're trying to get money out of the government or IBM or something. And lots of people care about this, and they're entitled to. And it's what do these rules let us do? We'd like kind of to do stuff. We'd like to be able to build magnificent flying machines and such like and so forth. And in particular, we'd like to be able to exploit these crazy correlations, which seem to give us a world of opportunity we can only just start to envisage. To do some crazy stuff. And it turns out you can do some crazy stuff. You can do quantum computing, for example. But we don't know yet exactly what that allows us to do and what it doesn't. We know some things. We can do quantum cryptography, unconditionally secure cryptography according to the laws of physics, which is it's a step forward from, you know, just, I don't know, using Enigma machines or whatever, relying on the laws of physics seems a bit more secure, and so forth. But this is only one motivation, really. I think most physicists working in the field, and certainly most physicists at the Institute here, really want to know instead what on earth this conspiracy is all about. Right? Every single particle in the universe is following the same set of rules, and we don't really have a good grasp on what those rules are. And that bugs the hell out of us. In particular, these, as we'll get to when I talk about entanglement, these particles seem to know what one another is doing, even at vastly separated distances. So, you know, when we quiz one particle over here, the other particle over there seems to somehow know what we did to that particle over there and respond accordingly, perhaps. And that bugs the hell out of us too, because how the hell did it do that? We have no clue. So really, we want to examine and study these rules and correlations, this giant global conspiracy, and work out just how paranoid we should be, basically. Okay, so that explains why we should look at the fundamentals of quantum theory. Doesn't really explain why we should look at quantum information theory. What's information got to do with it? Well, the insight here is that as physicists, and in fact as conscious beings in the world, a primary thing we have to do is we have to get information about the world. If you want to learn something about an object, you have to get information about it. That's the fundamental operation for learning anything about the world. All the physics, empirical science, is built on measurements and observations of the physical world. We want to know where things are, when events happen, how heavy the moon is, and all kinds of questions like that. And with every measurement we make, every observation we perform on an object, We're engaging in a physical interaction with that object in order to gain information about it. And thus, I mean, that's the basic explanation for why it's not unreasonable to expect information to play a crucial role in our physics, because physics is the very business of gaining information about the world through the rules of reality. That's what physics is. And it turns out that, yes, this is a good perspective to use on quantum theory, because the rules we apply to crank the handle and the framework of quantum theory is information theoretic. It's an information theoretic framework about how you can manipulate information and extract information from systems, and which you just paint in a colour-by-numbers fashion with, okay, this information is about electrons, let's call that object an electron, and therefore this property I'm talking about here, which behaves according to the rules of quantum mechanics, must be charge, so we'll just label that charge, and so on and so forth. But the underlying framework is the same in all cases, and it's information theoretic. It's about extracting information from physical systems. Now, if we're going to think about the very basics of information, because at this point, every theorist in physics worth his salt is going to run screaming for the most simple possible system they can imagine to try and start understanding quantum mechanics. We might, from a classical perspective, start with good old traditional variables like position and momentum. That is the way people usually introduce quantum theory to poor, unsuspecting students. by talking about probability density functions over wave functions. And it's all very well from a traditional approach. But information-wise, from my perspective in quantum information theory, a position measurement is an enormous undertaking to make, because you've got to obtain a pretty ridiculous amount of information about a physical system in order to know where it is. For example, this is roughly where we are. And here's a bit of data about where we are that you can glean from a standard experiment of loading up Google Maps. And it turns out we're 43 degrees north and 80 degrees west in Waterloo, approximately. Southwest Ontario, anyway. Now, this number ranges from north to about 180, and this is a bit, it can either be north or south. So this is about 360 values this can take. And there's 360 values this number can take too. So really, in determining our position to this level of accuracy, we're already discriminating between 360 squared possible physical states. And this is rubbish. We can go better. We're actually here at the moment, I think. Which I can know to roughly this level of accuracy. The number of possible states I have to distinguish to determine that we're here is mind-bogglingly huge. That's a ridiculously large amount of information. And in fact, as I go on and on doing a decent position measurement in a laboratory, I'm actually just accumulating arbitrarily much information, depending on how precise my measure is, tending towards preposterousness, which is all very well, but and that's great, and people should do that, people should know where they are. But if I want to start understanding the foundations of quantum mechanics, it might be nice if I could start by thinking about something a bit more modest. What's the simplest possible question I could ask the universe? I could interact with the universe and get an answer out. And that's really what quantum information is built on. Quantum information theory is built on yes or no questions. The simplest question you can ask of the universe is, are you X or aren't you? So you can ask an atom, for example, is your electron, say a hydrogen atom, are you in the ground state or are you in an excited state? You're one or the other, right? You can't be both. Surely. but these are questions we can ask, and they do have binary outcomes, right? If we study the world, you only ever see atoms in ground states or atoms in excited states. You don't see anything else. If you study cats, they're either dead or they're alive. Okay, it's a binary choice. So there are only two possible answers to these questions when we ask the universe these questions, yes or no. And this is the key kind of question to ask. Anyone who's played 20 questions, for example, knows that although these questions may seem very modest to start with, when you start racking them up, dividing things into binary choices, you can very quickly increase your amount of knowledge about the world and narrow things down very simply. So certainly classically, we know that you only need to ask yes or no questions about the universe in order to learn everything you know classically about the universe. So, I mean, that's kind of an insight behind classical computation. It's that the reason these computers, which all work on binary zeros and ones, can actually do such incredible things modeling our world, is because zeros and ones are all you actually need to play with in order to model classical reality. So this is really our model of classical physics. It perhaps looks slightly pejorative, but then that's the perspective quantum theorists have on classical physics. there are two states in classical physics. There's the state, yes, we've got something here, and there's the state, no, what are you talking about? It's a load of nonsense. And never the twain shall meet, really. Either the world has an alive cat in it, or it has a dead cat in it. And there's some explanation back in the distant past, probably, for why you were doing this to the damn cat in the first place. But certainly it's either one or the other. Now, so what goes right or wrong in the quantum view is this. There's no such thing as two disjoint, never the twain shall meet states anymore. Every binary question we can ask, every yes-no question we ask of the universe, is represented by this, which is an infinite set, a continuous surface over a sphere of possibilities ranging from the answer yes to the answer no. So we call this object here the Bloch sphere. It's just a simple kind of three-dimensional representation of the quantum state of a two-state system. So this is the kind of quantum equivalent of a bit, to call it a qubit, and it's that this state structure holds for any system that has two possible states, which is to say, any question you can ask the universe, which has two and only two possible answers, the universe is going to respond according to rules based on this. Now, if you ask grotesque classical questions about cats, then you've got to worry about decoherence and interference with the environment and such like, or anything else. But if you can actually narrow down the situation such that all the universe thinks you're concentrating on is the yes outcome and the no outcome specifically, then you get this kind of behavior, regardless of whether you're talking about energy levels in an atom or which of the two slits the photon went through or anything like that. Now, where do we get this infinite continuum of states from? I mean, yeah, this is where things get a bit tricky. First of all, do we have chalk somewhere? We do have chalk. Okay, so first of all, let me just establish for the time being Keck notation, which you've probably heard about already, but just to make sure it's really simple. Any time I've got a classical state, like say I've got a cat, I can write its state, and all I do is I just write its state and surround it with a bracket, and then I think I've done physics. So that's a perfectly valid quantum state, and in fact, this is a perfectly valid quantum state too. If this was actually an atom, this could be the equivalent of something that reads the atom's in an excited state, or the atom's in its ground state, or something like that. And these are just what we call quantum states. The key insight, as people have been drumming into you for all morning, possibly, from the sound of things, is that if you have any two different quantum states like this, doesn't matter what they are, so long as they're different, any two different quantum states, then any linear superposition of those, any complex linear superposition, is a valid quantum state. So the simple fact that those two are valid observable quantum states about the world, cats are alive and cats are dead, tells us, according to quantum mechanics, that this is a valid quantum state. And in fact, I can put just random complex numbers in front of this, alpha and beta, and this is a valid quantum state. And it's exactly this that generates this spherical structure here. We have two extreme states here that we're kind of building this up from. State 0, where the cat is alive, hooray! And state 1, where the cat is unfortunately demised. But all these intermediate possibilities are also perfectly real, generated by these two complex parameters, alpha and beta. And basically, the way you can picture this here is being generated from these. The difference in magnitude between the numbers alpha and beta is going to determine your latitude on this sphere, how close you are to the North Pole or the South Pole. So if beta is really big relative to alpha, you're going to be on a point somewhere low down here, and it's more likely the cat is there. And then these are numbers, so the difference in their complex phase, just how kind of separated they are from one another in their complex plane, is going to determine how far round you are on the sphere, what your longitude is. And we call these things basis vectors. This choice of alive and dead as the two outcomes of our measurement. When we study quantum systems like this, even though it's very tempting to think of this as an infinite set of states and we could always just narrow it down to which particular state we're at, that's not the way the world works. If we're studying a system like this, we've always got to get one and only one answer out. And we've always got to choose between two and only two choices. The Norton 1 are just dummy variables for any old basis choice of different states, like alive or dead, from which we can write down and expand the entire state. They're quite arbitrary choices, which I'll get to in a second. In particular, though, the lovely way of writing this down is that so long as they're opposites, like alive or dead, so long as they're on opposite sides of the block sphere, the complex numbers we have in front of them have this lovely property, that the square of their magnitudes are just the probabilities of getting those results if we do a measurement. So if we look at our atom or our cat, and we try to determine whether it's in its energetic alive state or if it's in its dead ground state, these numbers, the magnitude of that square is exactly the probability that we'll find it in that state. So as it were, the quantum state itself is encoding the possible outcomes of measurements right into it. But as I said, there's nothing special about my choice of naught or one here, or alive or dead, or excited state or ground state. Different measurements are perfectly possible as well. And in fact, any pair of points opposite one another on this block sphere is a valid measurement. And this is where things get a bit odd. We can also, according to quantum mechanics at any rate, it's equally valid to ask, is the state 0 plus 1 or is it 0 minus 1? It's kind of difficult to explain what that kind of measurement is in the ground state model. There are other fundamental physical objects where it's slightly easier to see what's going on here. For example, if we're talking about photon polarization, you can put a photon through a polarizing wave plate, and you can quite easily work out if it goes through, it must have been polarized in the horizontal direction, because that's the only way the waves will get through. If it doesn't go through, it must have been polarized in the vertical direction, because that's what happens. And lo and behold, after you put photons through such plates, they always turn out to be either in the vertical or the horizontal polarization direction, so that's 0 and 1. But if you just rotate your plate by 45 degrees, suddenly you're not distinguishing between vertical and horizontal anymore. You're distinguishing between plus 45 and minus 45, which is completely different observable. And again, there are only two outcomes. Everything's going to turn out to be either 45 degrees polarized or minus 45 degrees polarized, because it either gets through or it doesn't. But now you're talking about two different observables. For instance, 0 plus 1, which will be represented on the block sphere as 0 plus 1 and 0 minus 1. We always, though, have to ask a binary question. We always have to pick a pair of possible states, and that's our measurement. That's the only way we gain information about the world. We can't possibly learn these parameters about the physical state directly. And because our basis choice is entirely arbitrary, this is just a technical point, but it's quite important to understand in quantum theory, it's entirely arbitrary which set of points we choose in order to write down the state. So And this is just basic algebra. There's nothing special about this at all. This object is identical to that object. You just expand it out. Don't worry about the factors of root 2, which is slightly confusing. It's just normalization. But essentially, the relative strength of 0 and 1 and the relative phase of 0 and 1 in these two equations are identical. And that just means this state and that state are the same thing. They're two different ways of writing down exactly the same object. But this can make a difference. What this does is it tells us what the probabilities of the upper-mode measurement of 0 or 1 is, which is all very interesting. It's alpha squared, beta squared, exactly. But if we write the state like this, we see that the state also encodes the possible outcomes of measurements in the plus basis and the minus basis, respectively. So were we to perform a measurement that, for instance, was rotated to 45 degrees or with a wave plate on a photon, or were we to invent some crazy experiment where we look to see whether cats were alive plus dead or alive minus dead, these are the probabilities with which we'd expect to see the respective outcomes. And at this point, you can see that we get the uncertainty principle, essentially. And I just want to introduce the uncertainty principle from a quantum information theoretic point of view to emphasize that it seems to apply to every possible question you could ask. You don't need position and momentum and gigantic fields of possible uncertainty about where the thing's going to be and how fast it's going. All you need is one, exactly one, binary question to ask about the world. One two-state system, and you can generate the uncertainty principle in its entirety from that. Basically, if we... So, the way you can see measurements working pictorially when they happen, as a result of these probability observations. If I have a state, say, out in the middle of nowhere like this, and I perform a 0-1 measurement, so I want to distinguish between the two states, 0 or 1. All we really do is we project the state on somewhere onto this axis. So with high probability, because this state is very close to this state here, with high probability, it'll get projected to this direction, and we'll wind up with state 0. But there's always a small chance, that it's going to get flipped and projected into this direction, and we'll get the state 1. And that chance is directly related to this angle here. Now, as a result of this, you should be able to see that if I had this state here, the 0 plus 1 state, which is simply what's written here with the amplitudes correctly done, if I was to project this state, if I was to perform this measurement and this measurement, and project this state onto this axis, it's got no clue which way to go. And what actually happens is it just chooses randomly, completely, fundamentally randomly, and probability 1/2, it'll shoot up to project into a 0 state, and probability 1/2, it'll shoot down to project into a 1 state. So, and you can see this directly in the way the state is written here. This is the 0 plus 1 state. With probability 1 over square root 2 squared, it's going to produce the result 0, and with probability 1 over square root 2 squared, it's going to produce the result 1. So if we have a state, if we have this state, we're in a position of maximum uncertainty as to whether the result of a future measurement in a 0 or 1 basis would be 0 or would be 1. So, for example, if this were a momentum state, for example, you'd be in a state of maximum uncertainty as to whether the result of a measurement in a different basis, say position, were 0, would be one possible position or the other possible position. But you don't need to worry about whether one is momentum or one is position and such like. It's just any two-state or greater number of possible state system will have this kind of structure to it. Ditto, if we projected this state onto this axis here, we'd be in a state of maximum uncertainty. So if we're in this state, we're in maximum uncertainty about this possible question. But if we're in this axis already, so we know for sure what the outcome of this measurement is going to be, then we'll be in a state of maximum uncertainty about any measurement that's on this equator. So this is kind of irritating on a certain level, because there's just no way to get around it. There's no way we can know everything there is to know about a physical system in terms of the outcomes of future measurements. If you know the outcome of one future measurement, or one potential future measurement, then you're automatically in a state of maximum uncertainty about loads and loads of other possible measurements that you might perform on the same system, which are equally bad. Sucks. So this all seems kind of weird, but fortunately for IBM and such, like, we can actually use our real physical world to do classical computation, to get classical information out. We can just behave the way our intuitions tell us we should behave, if we stick defiantly to two possible states. So if we tell ourselves, well, look, forget about the rest of the possible states, capacitors are either charged or they're not. They're not some strange mixture of the two. There's either an electron there or there isn't. And we'll forget about everything else. And we'll be very careful not only never to look for other possible states, but also never to enact any physical process that will do anything other than flip us from one possible state to the other possible state and back again. So we'll never do anything strange to cats involving boxes and radioactivity. All we'll ever do is stroke them and take care of them, which is reasonable way to behave. If we do that, then we just extract quantum classical mechanics straight away. So classical theory is kind of embedded in quantum theory. It's a subset of possible operations in quantum theory is classical theory. But as physicists, that's not good enough, obviously, because if reality isn't restricted to playing by these rather prescribed rules, if reality is allowed to make different moves, do different things, have different correlations and such like, then that would we want to be able to know what they are, and we want to be able to do them too. So quantum information theory is really the study of how to... It's the study of the game the universe runs by. We want to know what the rules actually are, because the set of rules we've been operating seem kind of restrictive, and there are moves on... we can make with some of the fundamental pieces of the universe that we thought were forbidden. So we want to know what's going on. In particular, the fact that this rule set which the world uses is vastly larger than we thought it was means that there are new phenomena, new concepts, new things we can do that we didn't think we could do, new things, new ways in which the universe can behave that we didn't think were possible. And what I want to do now is talk about probably the most famous of these, which is entanglement. Certainly one of the stranger concepts in physics. And there is probably no concept that's more abused in pseudoscientific literature and such like than entanglement. I have lost track of the number of times I've read a news article or something like that, and someone is claiming that quantum entanglement explains why their particular theory for remote healing or telepathy or telekinesis or such like or aliens or what have you must be true. It's very popular in all kinds of strange contexts, in none of which is it represented accurately or correctly. Yeah?
Hi, sorry, just right before you go into that, I wonder if you... what would be the relation between this Lock-sphere representation and canonical variables? You know, like you're saying, with any, you know, like whether it's position or and momentum, I guess it works for energy and time or whatever, right?
Sure.
So, I guess, well, I could almost answer my question, so I'll ask you the second one. I mean, I guess the sort of non-one is sort of one variable, and then the equator is another one. Is that, would that be right?
Yes, that's okay. Kind of true, but. You've got to think of it in terms of, and this is where my drawing is about to go crazy bad, in terms of possible outcomes of measurements. So if you're performing a measurement which has, say, two mutually exclusive outcomes, like did the photon go through the left slit or did it go through the right slit, then that's just one bit of physical information picked up, one tiny bit, and you represent it in this form as a block sphere, which is actually just it's called the Hilbert space technically. It's a complex dimensional space with two vectors, one for each possibility, and the vectors are represented by complex numbers rather than real numbers. If you wanted to go to a system where there are three variables, you'd have to represent that in a space similar to this, but with three extremal points, not one and two. So if there are three possible slits the photon could go through or something like that, you're talking about a three complex dimensional vector space in which we represent the state. If you go up to something like position, and you argue that position is continuous, which is debatable, but it certainly seems a reasonable hypothesis that space is continuous, then all of a sudden there's an infinite number of possible outcomes to your measurement, in which case you need an object that's an infinite dimensional complex vector space, which is a valid physical object, and people can argue about that. Confuses the bejesus out of me, but which is why as quantum information theorists we tend to stick to the simplest possible things imaginable. The reason I'm being so reticent about drawing the shape of this space is that although we can embed a two-dimensional Hilbert space into the surface of a three-dimensional object like a sphere, which helps greatly to visualizing what's going on. When we switch to three-dimensional objects, just three different possible states about the world, this has to be represented on an eight-dimensional hypersphere. And it just explodes the complexity of the space you're talking about after that. So drawing a sphere on a blackboard, obviously I'm not actually that expert at, but you get the general gist. Drawing an eight-dimensional object on a blackboard is a bit tricky. But for canonical variables like position and momentum, rather than a two-dimensional complex space, you just have to use a dimensional space appropriate to the variable itself. So, unfortunately, in that case, it's infinite. As I say, entanglements, it kind of gets good press. It's very popular. It's not very accurate, but then, you know, all publicity is good publicity. But what I'd like to explore is what is an accurate view of entanglement and why it occurs and what we can do with it, what we can't do with it, and so on and so forth. This is the reason why it occurs here. It's just directly from superposition, as hopefully I'll show you. If you buy the superposition rule, you have to buy entanglement. It comes as a package. To consider entanglement, we have to consider two elementary quantum systems. We can't just stick to one elementary quantum system. We have to have two. But that just means we have to have two of these binary systems here. So we've got, if this is Alice over here, with her atom there, which is either in an excited state or a ground state, you just have Bob over here with exactly the same kind of system, which is an atom which might be in an excited state or a ground state, who knows. And we just start reasoning about this in exactly the same way as we did before. Suppose we were to measure the energy states of these atoms. What would be the possible result? Well, you could get a result where Alice and Bob were both turned out to be in the ground state. That's possible. You could get the result that one is in the excited state and the other's in the ground state. It's these two possibilities. Or they could both be in the excited state. It's pretty trivial. There's four possible answers here to measurements of the energy level of these atoms. And we can represent that just formally in Ket notation like this, where I'm just saying that if we say naught represents the ground state and one represents the excited state. This is just a way of writing down exactly the same thing. These are the four possible answers to ground state measurements on our system. But what does the superposition rule tell us? It tells us that if we have set of possible states of the system, like these four, then any complex linear sum of those states is also a valid quantum state. So I can just stick random complex numbers in front of these states, and all of a sudden I've got an equally valid quantum state for the two-state system. Now I'm now not talking about a two-dimensional space anymore. I'm talking about a four complex dimensional Hilbert space, so I'm not going to put that on the blackboard for obvious reasons. But it's simply these two simple spaces joined up, basically. For example, here's a possible state of the system, where we set all of these variables equal to a half. So we know how to read this. We just square the number, and that's the probability of getting the measurement result. So with probability 1/4, were we to look at the energy levels of the atoms, they both turn out to be in the ground state. And in fact, for this state, all the possibilities are equally likely. And what does that tell us about the system? It actually tells us that these two particles are not in the slightest bit related to one another. Because learning the ground state of the first system, for example, say we learn that the first system's in the ground state and the system's in the ground state, that just rules out these two possibilities here. So we only need to focus on this. But that gives us no information whatsoever about what Bob's state is. We still think that Bob is either with 1/2 probability in the north state or with 1/2 probability in the one state. So the two systems aren't in any way correlated. This is not entanglement. You can't get entanglement just by trying to mishmash all these states so that you get an even sum of them all. Yeah?
So when you found out information about Alice, you know that's in the ground state, and you eliminated those other two, then does that change the number in front there? Does that now become...
Yeah, it does. Sure. But the numbers are really just respecting the probability rule. Okay. So at the whole time. There's certainly no influence on the other, nothing happens to the other systems, for sure. And in particular, one way to see this, the great advantage of this notation, as hopefully we'll see in a minute, is it allows you to do everything with really simple algebra, and it corresponds to what's physically real. So this state, for example, I can write simply as, I mean, forgetting the halves for the time being. This is Alice, and this is Bob. Right? It's just this, 0, 0, 0, plus 0, 1, plus 1, 0, plus 1, 1. And you can kind of see here, that they're entirely separate systems. I can write them down individually, and we don't need to worry about one in order to write, don't need to worry about Bob in order to just write down what Alice's system's doing. Now, it doesn't stick this easy, of course. Because what about this possible state here? Where only two of the possibilities we allow for. Either the atoms are both in the ground state, or they're both in the excited state. Now we have a problem, because when we measure the energy of this, when Alice measures the energy of this atom over here, she's going to instantly find out what the energy of that atom over there is. And it doesn't matter whether Bob is sat on Alpha Centauri or not. The moment Alice measures this particle here, completely irrespective of the speed of light, she'll know exactly what Bob's system is going to do if he's making a measurement on it. If he makes a measurement on the future, and even if he made a measurement on it in a distant past, she knows instantaneously. When measuring the energy levels of this atom, we'll simply never see them in different states. So that is a correlation. That's a strong correlation between Alice and Bob. The energy states are inextricably linked. And that's entanglement. But, and that's where a lot of popular descriptions of entanglement leave off. And they kind of expect people to be impressed by this. Wow, that's entanglement. Their energy levels are inextricably linked across vast distances. How do they do it? It's not that impressive, that kind of correlation, because I can do exactly the same thing with a pair of socks quite easily. For example, I give you a guarantee that I'm actually reasonably competent in the mornings, not very competent in the mornings, but I'm competent enough that I'll always put on socks of the same color. If I show you one sock and show you that it's black, this sock is definitely black, you'll instantly know, despite the fact that my other sock is at quite a different location and you've not seen it, that my other sock is black. So we probably say I only got two kinds of socks in my sock drawer, which is not far from the truth. With, say with probability one half I'm wearing white socks, and with probability one half I'm wearing blank socks. That's a valid physical state, just valid classical physical state. It's very easy to generate that kind of state in the lab. We deal with this kind of stuff all the time. That seems to generate exactly the same correlation that I was claiming was impressive in a qubit. So all of a sudden, entanglement is just everyday stuff. Why does anyone get impressed by it at all? Of course, objects at distant locations can be very strongly correlated. There's a strong correlation between, all you need is a shared history between two objects, of some history of interaction, some that have to have been, you know, together in my software at some point. And then they can go off on their fanciful journeys elsewhere in the universe, but they'll always stay related by whatever dynamical interaction they had earlier, when I was choosing which sock to wear. So, and this is true, right? If all we ever do to this quantum system is ask each atom, what are you naught or are you one? Are you naught or are you one? All we'll ever get is this kind of correlation. And we'll never show that anything odd is going on. We'll never have any reason to suspect that anything odd is going on, other than that at some point in the distant past, someone got these atoms together and they were prepared by a process which guaranteed they were prepared at the same energy. Not surprising. But what if I ask a different question? Quantum mechanics tells me I can ask any question I like on this, this whole continuum of possible questions of this system, and I can ask any question I like of that system too. So what about I ask a slightly different question, specifically, in this basis instead? In both cases, so in both cases I'm going to ask a question in the plus-minus basis. At this point, to work out what happens in that case, in quantum theory and not quantum theory, all you need to do is just very simple algebra, which is a very foolish thing to say, as I'm about to try and do it.
It's on the floor.
Thank you. Okay. So first of all, let's consider what would happen if it's just a simple classical correlation. If we've got a situation where, with probability one half, we've got the state naught naught, and with probability one half, we've got the state one one, what would happen? Well, if we've got the state naught naught, say, and Alice, we've got Alice is in the state naught there, and Bob's in the state naught there. When they perform these plus-minus measurements on their systems, they're in a state of maximum uncertainty. So they're either going to collapse this way or that way with 50% probability. Either going to collapse this way or that way with 50% probability. So in other words, we just get all four results, where Alice collapses one way and Bob collapses the same way. I'll explain this in a second. We get all four of these results as possible outcomes, where plus is what I'm going to call that state for short, and minus is what I'm going to call that state for short. But always when I say minus, I'm basically talking about that state, and when I say plus, I'm basically talking about that state. So, and you can make exactly the same argument for the 1-1 state. So in other words, if we measure in the plus-minus basis, and we've got a probabilistic mixture of 0-0 and 1-1, the same way we have with the socks, then what quantum mechanics tells us is we'll lose all the correlations. This is exactly the same kind of state we had earlier on, where there were no correlations between them. There's no link between the outcome of Alice's measurement and Bob's measurement, because the outcome of Alice's measurement and the outcome of Bob's measurement are entirely independently random. Now, what happens if we do this with the entangled state? Okay, let me see if I can get the algebra right. So here's the entangled state. Now, this hopefully shows how easy it is to play around with quantum systems using linear algebra, using this notation. Naught, the state naught, is the same thing as this, which should be fairly easy to see because, identically, that's just naught plus one, that's just naught minus one, there, and that's just naught plus naught plus one minus one, which is going to just only leave the naught state standing, which is exactly what this is. So just by simple algebra, these two states are just two different ways of writing exactly the same quantum state in the same basis. So I can just rewrite, track down the eraser. So I can just rewrite this state here, but using different, instead of using the naught one description of what's going on in these subsystems, I'll use the plus minus description of what's going on in these systems. So for example, the state naught naught is actually going to be 1 over root 2 times this. So that's what? Plus, minus, like so. That's what naught naught equals. That for Alice, that for Bob. And that sums, much like that, to an equal superposition of plus, minus, minus, plus, minus, minus. But what about the other state here? I've got to include that one as well. So the 1, 1 state is going to be based on what 1 is equal to. What's 1 equal to? Well, it's actually equal to this. Plus minus minus. So what we will get consequently to this is we'll get the plus plus as before, but there'll be a minus sign here in front of the plus minus, and a minus sign in front of the minus plus, and then we'll get the minus minus as before. Okay? So when we sum, just when we look for what this is, which is simply the sum of naught naught and 1 1, the sum of this and this, what we're going to do is cancel out the states in which we get different results. A bit like magic. And when we write down the state then, finally, in the plus plus basis, so replacing this with this notation, it turns out that we write the state like this. Because the different results cancel out. It's almost as if nothing has changed from the original state, which was highly correlated. Despite the fact that we're looking at a completely different observable, we've got exactly the same correlations popping out of this entangled state. Whereas the probabilistic mixture that I did with a pair of socks loses all the correlations completely when we look at something other than sock color. So, as you can see from that, hopefully that wasn't too completely obscure, that it's just trivial algebra, really. That when we ask a different question, if we have a classical mixture, we lose all the correlations, they get washed out immediately. So sure, you can be correlated for one observable, but you certainly can't do the whole lot. With an entangled state, the correlations exist strongly for every possible question we might ask. And that's kind of spooky. Whatever question we ask system A a question, and it projected itself, say, we asked system A a question, are you in the plus basis or the minus basis? And it projected itself up here, say we got the result plus. Somehow, this system over here knows that it's got to behave as though it's plus two. So it will respond to all future measurements as though it's plus. But nobody should have told it that we performed a measurement in the plus-minus basis. If we performed a measurement in the 0-1 basis over there, this state would have had to have behaved as though it was a completely different state, one of those two, which has quite a different behavior pattern. So somehow, Bob over there seems to be learning what measurement we performed, or learning the outcome of the measurement we performed on Alice over here, which seems downright crazy. That's entanglement. but there's a catch, because at the moment it seems nice. We have Bob and Alice being able to somehow Bob's system seems able to know what we did to Alice's system, and Alice's system seems to be able to know what we did to Bob's system. So at this point, I think everyone who learns about it thinks, fantastic, faster than light communication, I'm going to win a Nobel Prize. Because there's got to be some way of proving this, right? If this state plus and this state naught, into which Bob's system gets forced by our choice of measurement over here, really do behave differently, surely there's some way that Alice can tweak this system or torture it in some way, such that Bob can tell she's doing something over there. And all it takes is Bob to be able to tell that Alice is doing something, anything, and Alice can tap out a Morse code message to Bob, no problem whatsoever. We get instantaneous communication, we talk faster than the speed of light, causality breaks down, special relativity dissolves, and we really are in trouble. Or either that or we get Star Trek, one or the other. do you want to take a risk? They can't do it. This is the primary property that people tend to use when they're saying, wow, quantum entanglement, therefore telepathy, therefore quantum healing, therefore remote viewing, therefore everything. But they can't do it. They can't do it precisely because of quantum randomness. And just to explain why that is, say Alice performs the plus-minus measurement over here. She's either going to get the result plus or she's going to get the result minus. But it's entirely random which result she gets. It will. Now, philosophers and physicists here certainly argue at great length about whether it actually has an effect on Bob's system at all. But what's for sure is that it doesn't have a noticeable effect on Bob's system. Because Bob goes from a position of having a maximally entangled state where whatever measurement he performs, the result will be entirely random, to a position of having a specific one of two completely random states. And there's no way for Bob to tell the difference between those two possibilities. Essentially, having this completely entangled state gives Bob... There's an equal chance of every point on the block sphere turning up for the state when he performs his first measures. But if he's collapsed to one of two possibilities, say, he's either there or he's there, entirely randomly, which is what Alice's action will have, so the probability half he's here and the probability of half he's here, it shouldn't be too hard to see that for any measurement he might perform, any axis he might perform here, any axis he might perform here, although with probability one half it's more likely to give this result than that result, with probability one half it's equally likely to give that result more than that result, so he'll just generate a random bit. So although when Alice and Bob compare notes after their measurements, they're going to look at it and go, wow, that's spooky, you got the same result I did, or your result was strongly correlated with mine. I never would have guessed that. When they actually perform the measurements themselves, they don't spot any correlation. In fact, they can't tell whether the other system's been measured or not. There's no information transfer between the systems at all. And therefore, relativity survives. But these are kind of contradictory. This is why people have a tendency to ignore whichever one of those two statements they don't like. On the one hand, I'm boasting that entanglement is great. It's got incredibly strong correlations, much stronger than is classically possible. On the other hand, I'm saying that these correlations are so weak that we can't possibly send the tiniest amount of information from one system to another using them, which is odd. And it might actually cause you to doubt my first claim, because push comes to shove, I didn't actually prove a great deal. All I actually showed on the blackboard was that you couldn't reproduce the behavior of entangled quantum state with a pair of socks. But you might feel, and a lot of people have felt over the last 80 years and argued strongly for it, there's still a debate raging about it, you might feel that you can get away with, you can reproduce these quantum correlations if you just allow a bit more than a pair of socks. Specifically, what about if we use an infinite number of socks and we allow people to have all the colors of the rainbow? So we'll allow Alice and Bob to share an infinite amount of prior information about, and prior strategizing about what they're going to do, and have huge, complicated systems. Surely in that case, we ought to be able to generate the same kind of correlations. Surely there's some kind of scheme we can concoct where we get the same kind of entanglement correlations between the two. And this appeals very much to our instincts as regards quantum entanglement. It's also a very fundamental question. It's a very active area of research. Our intuition should tell us, or it does tend to tell us, especially if we've grown up with Newton, that all the behavior of Alice's system here is going to be determined by just two things. It's going to be determined by whatever we do to Alice's system, whatever we choose to do to Alice's system, and it's also going to be determined by whatever inherent properties Alice's system has. So Alice's system will have a set of properties, like it'll have position, it'll have momentum, it'll have some set of things going on with it. And whatever we do to it, plus those properties, equals the outcome. Specifically, it shouldn't matter what Bob does, especially if Bob's on Alpha Centauri. What Bob does to his system should be irrelevant to working out what happens here. And also, it should be irrelevant what Bob's physical properties are. It shouldn't matter what state Bob's system is in. I mean, maybe it's correlated, maybe we pick the same color sock, but what happens to my left sock only depends on the fact that my left sock is black. It doesn't depend on the color of my right sock. So this intuition is local realist. It's very popular. It's Einstein was an enormous fan of it and wrote a few papers desperately trying to argue against quantum theory because he preferred local realism. Turns out it's wrong, which is very strange. And the proof that it's wrong is essentially the proof that entanglement is something strange and spooky and non-classical. And these proofs are hard, difficult to enact. Specifically, it's all very well me standing in the room talking about that being Alpha Centauri and this being Earth. But in fact, it's not. They're quite close to one another. And if I want to run an experiment proving that Bob is non-locally separated from Alice, if I want to rule out the possibility that there's some secret communication the universe is passing between them, I actually have to do these two experiments at space-like separated locations, such that no light signal could possibly get from one to the other in time to influence the results of the other measurement. That's possible. People do this. They do this at opposite sides of Lake Geneva. They've done it in the Canary Islands and things like that, just bouncing from one island to another. The key thing being you want a bit of distance between your experiments, and you want to be able to run your experiments crazy fast, such that there's no possibility of a light signal going between the two. But it's very hard to do. Specifically when you think of inefficient detectors which may or may not detect a photon passing through them and so on and so forth. And proofs of non-locality, the proofs that these correlations are technically stronger than anything you can do with infinite numbers of socks, are very vulnerable to experimental errors. The statistical are saying the balance of these correlations means we should get this result slightly more often in the quantum case than we get it in the classical case. But if you just, you know, introduce a few error bars into that, all of a sudden, people who don't believe in quantum mechanics can shout, but you haven't proved the thing. So in the past 10 years or so, we've developed a new kind of proof, which is the state of the art in terms of proving that quantum mechanics genuinely is non-local. And that kind of proof is called the pseudo-telepathy game. It's a game that contestants can play, such that they can win the game if they share a quantum entangled state. But if you didn't know anything about quantum mechanics, the fact that they can win the game ought to convince you that they're using telepathy, because there's just no way they could win the game otherwise. So it's a game show, but it's also fundamental physics. And this is how papers are actually framed in this. I'm going to present a specific pseudo-telepathy game that's called the Magic Square game, which is probably the best one we've got at the moment. And it basically works like this. We've got two contestants, Alice and Bob. We're going to ask Alice and Bob some questions. We're going to ask them these questions once they're in sealed booths, and they'll have to give certain set responses to the questions. They can win simply by producing answers that satisfy some winning condition. We'll tell them, we're going to help them, we're going to tell them what the questions we might ask them are before we set them in the booths. And not only that, we'll allow them to strategize, to plot arbitrarily long before they split up into their booths. So in other words, this is really a model for particle behavior. If we imagine these two as fundamental particles or physical systems, they're allowed to share any kind of information, any kind of interaction they like. And then they can walk off with their set of physical properties. They can walk into these booths with enormous, great big documents of strategy. They can have little laptops with predicting things, running software, telling them how to answer the questions. They can do anything. They can have scribbled notes, whatever. They can have things written on their hands. It's all perfectly allowed in these booths. But what goes into the booth with you stays with you in the booth. You can't communicate from one to the other. So the question is, can they devise a strategy before they walk into these booths such that they can answer the questions in such a way that they satisfy our correlations? Well, it depends on the game, obviously. There are some questions you might ask quite easily. For instance, we might ask them to play the game of, we're going to ask you to name an animal, and you have to name the same animal. That's a pretty damn easy game for Alice and Bob to win. They just agree on a strategy beforehand, which is, tigers are cool, let's both say tiger. And then they win when we say name an animal. They both name tiger, and we go, wow, crazy correlations, how did you do that? Well, it's obvious how they did that. So we need to be a bit clever at devising our test. And this is what we use. It's called a magic square. And it's the property of this square is the following. Every row adds up. We put a 1 or a 0 in each box. And every row will add up to an even number. And every column will add up to an odd number. Now, what's magic about this? Well, what's magic about the eraser? Okay. What's magic about this is that it's completely impossible. And it's impossible for a... It's quite easy to see why it's impossible. Let's just try briefly. If I want the top row to be even, I might say 1, 1, 0. Say that sums to an even number, it sums to 2, which is lovely and even. That's a perfectly valid top row to put in. Now, I've got to have this column be odd, so it's got to sum to either 1 or 3. So let's say it sums to 1. I have to put a couple of zeros in there. So we're doing well so far. This column has to be even. Now, it's either going to sum to 2 or 0. Let's say it sums to 2. Put 2 ones there. That's doing well so far still. This column has to be odd. Well, it can't be 1 anymore. It's got to be 3. So it will be 3. Now, this column has to be odd. So this must be a 0. And this row has to be even. So it's got to be a 1. So something went wrong there. But, you know, I was just making it up as I went along, to be fair. And we didn't work in the end, but maybe I made a mistake earlier on. Is there some way we can prove that this is completely impossible? And it's actually quite easy to understand why this is completely impossible. If we sum up all the rows, each row sums to an even number. Even plus even plus even equals even. So all the entries in this box, in this magic square, add up to an even number. If I sum the columns, on the other hand, odd plus odd plus odd equals odd. So all the columns add up to an odd number. So all the entries here add up to an even number. So a magic square exists if and only if there is an odd number that is also an even number. And this is not the case. So there is no such thing as a magic square. Why does this help us play a game with Alice and Bob? Well, we're going to be nasty to them. We're going to ask them to prove to us that they are thinking of a magic square. We don't want them to necessarily specify it exactly, but we want them in their booths to prove to us that they've got in their mind's eye a picture of an actual magic square. And we're going to do this as follows. We're going to randomly pick a row, and we're going to ask Alice, what are the entries in your row? We might say, pick row two, and say to Alice, what are the entries in the row that you're thinking of? And Alice will have to respond with three numbers corresponding to her row factor as well. Naught. She's got to respond at an even row. She'd be foolish to do otherwise. So she'll respond 0, 0, 0, or 0, 1, 1, or 1, 0, 1, or 1, 1, 0. That's the possible answer she can give. We'll do the same for Bob. We'll pick a column at random and ask him, please tell me the numbers in your column. And he'll have to respond with a series of three numbers which sum to an odd number. How will we know that they're actually thinking of a magic square? Well, we're going to compare the answers they give, and we're going to give them the points, and we're going to say they can win the game if and only if we spot we can't detect their lie. We're going to be generous here, so we're going to give them the benefit of the doubt. So long as they agree on the entry, they absolutely have to agree with it if they're both thinking of the same square. We'll give them the benefit of the doubt and they can win. But if they give a different answer here, then we'll know for sure they were just making it up as they're going along. They aren't thinking of a magic square, and they'll lose. Now, classically, there's just no way they can get around this. Maybe you can think about it for a while or think about it afterwards, but whatever strategy you take into the booth with you, whatever prior arrangement you make, however long you chat, Alice and Bob chat, and whatever they take into the booth on pieces of cardboard to help them work things out. There's no way they can get around the fact that we're asking them to prove something impossible. Specifically, you know, we might ask them this question. If we ask Alice 2 and Bob 1, the best they can do is they can pick a magic square like this one. Is that the same one? Yes, it is. They can pick a magic square like this one, which is correct in all but which kind of is working right up until you reach the last entry, such that so long as we quiz them about that, or that entry, so long as that's the intersection, they can bluff us. We won't spot the mistake. But if by chance we happen to ask them about the questionable entry, they are screwed. They don't even know that we're asking them about the questionable entry when we do, because Alice, for example, if Alice were asked question 3, name your third row, she doesn't know at that time whether we've asked Bob to name his first row or his second row or his third row. So she's locked in for giving the answers that she knows Bob would give for the first row and the second row already. So she's actually got to output for the third row the entry that makes sense for her, which is going to screw them if we've asked Bob the third question. And it's fairly simple to prove, in fact, that you might that even if they randomly switch between different squares like this, which is the best they can possibly do, just randomly switching between these different squares to try and fool us, so long as we retaliate by randomly switching between which row we ask, each time we do it, we've still got a 1/9 chance of hitting their mistake. So in other words, there's simply nothing that Alice and Bob could take into the booths with them such that they win this game more than 8/9 of the time. And remember, Alice and Bob are just physical systems. So there's no collection of properties. No collection of physical properties, one physical system could have by itself, that allowed it to win this kind of game more than 1/8 of the time. The fun thing about quantum mechanics is that Alice and Bob can win this game guaranteed. So if we play this game multiple times, and we're very quickly going to be able to tell the difference between whether Alice and Bob are winning the game all the time, or whether they're repeatedly making mistakes. Because the first time they make a mistake, we'll think, aha! And allowing for experimental error, if they make a lot of mistakes, about 1/9 mistakes, we'll think, aha! So if we didn't know quantum mechanics, to win this game, the only way they can win this game is if Alice knows what question we ask Bob, such that they can agree between them on a magic square where this isn't the bogus entry, where the bogus entry is somewhere else. But if Alice doesn't know what question we've asked Bob, there's no way they can dodge the possibility that we're going to hit their bogus entry. So that looks like telepathy. But with quantum mechanics, we can win the game the whole time. And it's a little complicated, but I'll give you the gist, hopefully. We win with this entangled state here. It's an entangled state for two, Alice has a four-dimensional system here, just two basic systems. And Bob has two basic systems over there. And this is an entangled state of the four system overall. What Alice and Bob are going to do is they're just going to take their system and perform a rotation. This is simply, these are unitary operations. They're really simply just rotations in Hilbert space. So for example, if you've got, this is something you can always do. If you've got a state, say, that has one particular outcome in Hilbert space, you can always just unitarily evolve the system and rotate it such that you just rotate it in Hilbert space like so. And you can do this even if you don't know which state you've got. So if you're in a system where you've either got state 0 or state 1, you can apply a unitary operation to your system and it's just going to smoothly rotate to a system where identically you've either got state plus or state minus with the same probabilities. This is something that's just unitary evolution in quantum mechanics, which is what happens all the time if you don't perform a measurement. What Alice and Bob are going to do is just perform different rotations on each subsystem according to the questions they're asked. So if Alice is asked question 2, she'll perform this unitary operation, this particular rotation operator, on her vectors. If Bob is asked question 3, he'll perform this operation on his. And you're just going to have to take my word for it, because I'm not going to put all the algebra on the screen. But it's simple linear algebra. It's nothing else, nothing more remarkable than that. If we do enact those two operations, for example, if we ask Alice question 2 and Bob question 3, what happens is they just perform these two operations, and by the magic of linear algebra, they get this state that they now share, which is also entangled. So in fact, equally entangled. There's no change to the entanglement. It's just a different way of writing the state under these rotations. But what can they do in this case here? Well, Alice now simply does the following. Alice has the first two systems, right? And Bob has the second two systems inside each bracket. So Alice has the first two bits, and Bob has the second two bits. They just have to perform measurements in the 0-1 basis, such that, for example, let's say they project up the system and they get this first result, 0-0-0-0. This is, remember, the probability of getting each result. So if they perform these measurements, they stand a 1/8 chance of every single result. And so probably 1/8, they'll get this result. But in this case, Alice has a very simple strategy. She's just going to output what she read. She's going to output 0-0 as her first two bits. And then she's going to think, well, 0-0, I've got to be even. My third bit will be 0. I'm bound by that. I've got to be even. It's second state. So Alice has chosen 0-0-0. Bob, meanwhile, is going to do the same thing. He's got 0-0, and his third bit has to be 1, because he's got to be odd. But what have this row and this column actually done? Well, Alice had to put 0-0-0, and we asked in her second row. And we asked Bob for the third column. He had to put 0-0-1. They agree where they have to agree. So we haven't caught them out. And in fact, if you note, there are 8 possibilities here. Turns out those 8 possibilities correspond identically to the 8 possible winning squares of the magic square game. So even though they're answering completely at random, based on these entangled measures, even though there's an equal chance of all the math putting all possible valid strings, they're still correlated in such a way that they always win the game. Which is odd. They never find out, for example, what the other question the other person was asked. Classically, the only way you could win is if telepathically you somehow learned if Alice somehow learned what question Bob was asked and responded accordingly. But with an entangled state, you can somehow generate exactly the same correlations, the winning telepathic correlations, as it were, without ever learning what questions the other system was asked. So the key point here is it's impossible utterly impossible to account for these correlations, the correlations here and the correlations there, with local realism, with an account of reality that whereby it's only the properties of this system right here, only what Alice took into the booth with her and what we did, what we asked Alice when we were asking her questions, that determine what happens in this booth here. Something else matters for what happens here. And something else matters for what happens there. And that's the non-local effect in quantum theory. And it all boils down to superposition. It's all from entanglement, and it's all simply from this superposition principle. It's all from the fact that really these aren't just individual particles behaving like this. They're in some way, they've got this slightly wave-like behavior, etc. So if I just skip past the other again, this is quantum non-locality, which has these two counterintuitive properties. It's so strong that it's impossible to reproduce. Even if you allow Alice and Bob an infinite number of socks, an infinite amount of planning, and the Encyclopedia Britannica with them in the booths, with prior strategizing for as long as they like, they can't do the same thing. They can't get close to winning this game as often as they could if they just had two little atoms in a quantum state in the booth with them. Incredibly strong correlations, and yet the correlations are so appear so randomly from a local perspective until you compare notes afterwards that no information can pass between the systems, so we don't break the speed of light whatsoever. This is just, I kind of can't possibly give a talk on non-locality without having John Bell somewhere in it, so he's just crammed in down there. He's the guy who came up with the important results and started this whole business of proofs of non-locality to begin with, in contravention of what Einstein said was going on to Athens. It's a clever chat. Why does the universe behave in this fundamental way? Why on earth do we have these crazy correlations linking different events in this fashion? Not clear. And that's the point on which I'm going to have to end, because really quantum information theory is it's in its infancy and we haven't got a clue why the universe behaves this way. We're only just starting to understand how it behaves, let alone get at the reasons underlying it. But ask again in 20 years. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that very stimulating presentation. So we're a little bit over time, so we have lunch waiting for us out there, which is gradually being eaten by researchers. But I think so we do have time for one question, and if anyone has any questions after that, maybe we can persuade Jonathan to stay down in front for a while. So are there any questions that... Yes,
I'm not sure how you got from the four states to the two states. Why do you go from
where to where?
Yeah, from the possible states to consider the state. Like, why did you go there?
Well, basically, I'm allowed to. Where's my stick? I'm allowed to put any variables here that I like. Any complex numbers, and it's a valid physical state.
Okay.
So there are. Oh, it's a different slide. So there are. There is a valid state where all of these numbers are the same. They're just one half, one half, one half, one half. That's a perfectly valid physical state. That's not an entangled physical state. As we saw, we get four entries. We've got four entries there. The systems aren't correlated at all. Equally, I could have the entry one there, 0, 0, 0, and we just have a physical state perfectly valid where they're both in the ground state. But according to the superposition principle, I've got to consider every possibility, including the possibility where it's something like 1 over root 2, 0, 0, 1 over root 2. This possibility, in fact. In which case, it turns out these states have some rather odd properties in that they're entangled.
How do you do that physically? How do you entangle things?
They need to be dynamically linked in some fashion, basically. So it's complicated, and it's certainly not my area of expertise, but there are certain physical processes that produce it. For example, the decay, when certain particles decay, they send off particles separately. When photons can decay in a parametric down converter such that they become too low a frequency, one higher energy frequency photon kind of splits into two lower frequency photons. And in that case, just the dynamics of how we understand photons work, they're obeying quantum mechanics, they're splitting into an entangled pair. They don't, it's kind of odd.
Can I just add that? So yesterday at the Institute for Quantum Computing, when you went to Gregor Weiss's lab, the Austrian guy with the shaved head, he makes states like that. It uses, down to the merger, talked about the blue light going to red light. That's how you make that.
Yeah.
So, just before we go to lunch, so Julie is out there. A few people asked about selling that Lipsing PI t-shirt, so, and taking the Quantum World t-shirts from the